720 WGN. Hey there, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. Lots to do on the program today. A little bit later, we're going to be talking about some news from Walmart. We've seen Walmart in headlines a lot this week, so we're going to be digging into that. But before we do, there's another company that's been in headlines a lot lately, and that is Facebook. They're making some more tweaks to the algorithm to change what we see when we log in and look at our news feed. And here to discuss that with us, tech reporter at New York Times, Mike Isaac. Mike, thanks for being with us today. Welcome back to the program.
Hey, Amy, thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us and taking time out of your Saturday. So talk us through this. I think generally, usually when Facebook has any kind of changes, I mean, even changing the logo font, people tend to kind of lose their minds. Mm-hmm. And this one seems like it's going down a little bit better.
Yeah, this is it's a really it's a big change first of all, and so last week Mark Zuckerberg had me come into the office and sort of lay out what is going to happen here, and it's kind of it's a little bit vague right now, but essentially after the past year, Facebook took a ton of flack for what role it had in influencing the outcome of the election, the spread of sort of fake news across the network. A lot of the problems it has with these sort of filter bubbles and insular ways that people sort of cordon off and talk to themselves across the site. So their whole point is the way people enjoy using their network and actually feel good about it, according to research that they've done, is to actually interact with people instead of just having it as a place for news and video and sort of passive content that's flowing through there. So in essence, what they're trying to encourage is what they call meaningful interactions between people, which could be a long comment or more likes or basically more talking on Facebook. And that's probably what you're going to see a lot more in your feed. So if I'm talking to you or leaving longer comments on your status updates, then that you'll probably see a lot more of that in your feed than, say, a New York Times article or something, or a long video, perhaps.
Right. And I I'm reminded of when Facebook really first became mainstream and you no longer had to have an EDU email address to use it. Mm-hmm. A lot of people were often working in that digital media space were kind of describing it to people, usually selling it to brands, as saying this is like, mm-hmm, walking down Main Street and interacting with the people that you know. And this is a way you can find your consumers and their tribe, their people. So it's in a way a bit of a return to that, but I can't help but wonder what the revenue impact is going to be.
Yeah, that's totally right. Well, I think so. Part of the way that they were, that Mark was describing, was, this is how we started out. Like you said, you first had to have a college email address, and then, they slowly opened it up to more. But essentially, it was where you went to connect with your friends and family and, see pictures of dogs or babies or whatever's going on in your family's lives. And, as Facebook now has more than 2 billion monthly users, brands and publishers are putting videos and articles on there. Everyone's just sort of fighting for attention in the newsfeed. And so part of what people actually said to Facebook is, look, what we want to come to Facebook for is to actually talk to our friends and family like we did in the first place. So it's kind of strange. Every time Facebook makes a big thing, like you said, everyone gets sort of worried and bent out of shape. But this is actually what people kind of see Facebook as being used for in the first place. So perhaps that's why it's actually going better for them.
Right. And it does. I'm not surprised by this at all. It seems like we last year, and I say this anecdotally, but it seemed like we, mm-hmm, last year reached this point where I think everybody just had this content fatigue and nothing felt, mm-hmm, connected. Everything felt very disjointed. And I remember, even just in the last weeks of 2017, a lot of people seemed to be on Facebook complaining, like, or on Twitter and Facebook rather, complaining like this is just an endless scroll of bad news. So this is not surprising. Mm-hmm. And in a way, this does seem like a really positive step.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, one of the things that they were focusing on this week is what they call passive content. So think about when you or I like watch TV or watch a YouTube video or a Facebook video, I guess, online, there's not really much that we're doing. We're just sort of taking in information. And according to studies, you know, inside and outside of Facebook, people actually don't necessarily feel so great after they're just sitting there and watching this torrent of bad news about the world coming at them. And Facebook's whole thesis is, well, maybe if we can get you actually talking to people and interacting with people, even if that's online, you're probably going to come away feeling better than you did if you were just watching videos about, you know, some horrible thing happening in the world, which actually doesn't seem crazy. So right. I'm very curious as to how people, you know, react to this as they start seeing their news feeds change in the next few weeks.
Right, right. The only kind of interesting, unique, you know, interesting and unique point I saw that I thought was kind of worth a pause was there was a nonprofit that I'm connected with on Facebook, and they were saying, you know, hey, we really depend on you know, grassroots fundraising and really depend on our small community of people. We know there's Facebook changes coming up. I hope you'll be mindful of us and stay connected in other ways, which is kind of another interesting point. You know, it's easy to say, oh, okay, that's fine. We'll find our big news stories anyway, but with these smaller grassroots organizations, I think that will be interesting to see how that shakes out.
Absolutely. I mean, the sort of unintended, or actually I would say intended, but, you know, interesting byproduct of Facebook being so enormous is that everyone from, you know, my company, the New York Times, to smaller brands and nonprofits and little mom and pop shops, they rely on Facebook to get their sort of message out or to advertise to them. And so Facebook, this has been a problem for a long time for Facebook. Once you sort of change the algorithms that decide what people see, it can have a huge effect throughout everyone that relies on the network. So right now, everyone's sort of bracing for what that change is going to be. They don't fully know, and Facebook has sort of given a lot of warnings throughout this past week, but I think everyone is just really worried that, you know, maybe tomorrow their business actually goes away. So it's a really good point. Like, there are potentially negative side effects that could affect more than just, say, a publisher or big brands like, you know, like Fortune 500 companies.
Right, right. Well, lots to consider, but we'll have to just kind of wait and see. Mike Isaac, tech reporter at New York Times, thanks so much for being with us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Have a good one. All right, we're going to take a little break, and back in just a bit, a little bit later in the show, we're going to be talking about big changes coming for Walmart workers. Back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. You know, before we get to our next guest, let us check in with our good friend Kevin Powell of WGN Radio. Hey, Kevin, how are you? Down at the Sprint store today?
Amy Guth, yeah, thanks for letting me jump on. 1406 East 53rd Street in Hyde Park. I'll be there from 1 to 3. The first 50 people who show up get a $50 gift card, $50 in your pocket. You can learn about Sprint's new unlimited plan, which if you compare to other national carriers, 50% less than AT&T, Verizon, T-Mobile. Come hang out at the Hyde Park store. Again, $50 gift cards to the first 50 people. I'll be there from 1 to 3. If you can't make it, go to sprint.com/unlimited. Find out about Sprint's new unlimited plan.
Easy enough. Thanks so much, Kevin. Have fun down there.
Thank you, Amy. Appreciate it.
All right. Bye-bye. All right. So lots to do. We had to check in with Kevin real quick, but lots to do on the program today. Still a little bit later on the other side of news, we're going to be talking about changes coming for Walmart workers. We've been all seeing those headlines, so we're going to make sense of that, of course. We're joined now by Esther Fung, who is a reporter at Wall Street Journal, joining us to talk about, this is a really, really interesting piece. It really got my attention when I saw it. It's about how landlords are less and less interested in calling properties malls, even when they are literally exactly malls. Esther, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
So let's talk about this. What is the resistance to using the word mall? Is it we're just trying to use more upgraded language, or is there something else behind this?
So for a few years now, it feels like less and less people are going to the malls, given that the migration to online shopping. And there are also many more instances of malls and some parts of the United States where they have become neglected. There wasn't much maintenance, and they've slowly become vacant. So there appears to be a negative impression and perception of malls these days, and some landlords are saying, okay, we might have to rebrand our properties.
Well, it's an interesting idea, but it seems kind of, it seems like there's so much more to it than just language. I mean, we've talked many times on this program about the how brick and mortar locations, retail locations are really suffering because of the convenience of online shopping. And it doesn't seem like language is really going to fix it. Does the developer industry really feel like calling it, such and such crossing or corners or whatever? Does that solve for them?
No, absolutely not. There are some landlords who still use malls in their properties, and they would say the last thing they want is for people to just change the name of a mall and not do anything about it. You've got to keep them updated, bring in new tenants, make sure the place is clean, definitely make it a place where consumers want to go to. It's really not just a place where you go to buy a product, given the convenience of online shopping these days.
Right, and go ahead.
Yeah, and they like, and some of them would deliberately tell us, you cannot use the word mall when describing our property. Especially if they are renovating it and trying to include other components such as apartments or hotels or offices, and then it becomes a mixed-use center. But for regular people on the street, they especially those who grew up with the mall, they still call it that's the mall,
Right.
They're not. It's hard for them to call it something else.
Well, sometimes things are just what they are. Sometimes things are, that is the name for them. And I mean, I get it. Of course, we see this in real estate. We see this in a lot of different, anytime you're trying to shift user behavior, just renaming something sometimes is useful.
Yes.
But I think there's even subcategories though that's really looking at making shopping in a physical space a lot more experiential, a lot more kind of a more bespoke, special kind of experience. So we're seeing words like retail-dential, when you have this mixed-use residential and retail, and even mixed-use property, we're seeing those things that maybe is pointing to a sense of kind of digging into specificity of type of location.
Yes, that's right. There are all sorts of terms that the industry sometimes use, like lifestyle center, power center, mixed-use, open-air center. These are pretty jargony, and sometimes shoppers tell me they're just trying too hard. Bring in the more up to date retailers. Make sure the toilets are clean.
Right. Put in a little landscaping, make it nice. Right.
Yeah. I must say some of them do it. But shoppers, they know when it's just a rebranding and nothing else has changed.
Right. I mean, I think even some of the higher end kind of open air shopping center areas, even I think in our common language, I think people still call it a strip mall, even if it's fancy and landscaped and there's a fountain and all this kind of stuff in the middle. I think people say, oh, if you go down this street, there's a strip mall on the right with a Macy's in there. And, I think that's going to be a tough sell for developers to get that out of our language.
Yes, I have gotten into trouble with some of them because of this before, and I'm so glad you brought it out.
Well, it shall be interesting. Well, thanks so much for raising this issue, and we'll continue to turn to you, Esther Fong, reporter at Washington Post, Wall Street Journal. About the latest on this. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
All right. So we're going to take a little break, get you to news, all that good stuff. On the other side of news, we're going to be talking about some headlines connected to Walmart workers. I'm sure you've seen them. We're going to talk all about them here in just a bit on 720 WGN. Hey there, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. Always grateful to you for sharing part of your Saturday with me. Still lots to do here on the second half of the program. A little bit later, we're going to be talking about this trend of Chicago hospitals giving permanent housing to homeless patients. We're going to be talking with Chicago Tribune workplace reporter Alexia Elhalde Ruiz about that. But right now, we're joined by Washington Post reporter Todd Frankel, who wrote about the wage increase that's coming to Walmart workers. But that was announced, and then immediately after was announced that over 60 stores are going to be closing. So lots going on there, lots to make sense of. Todd, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you.
So talk us through this, because it seemed like a kind of a 1-2 punch set of news stories here from Walmart. We saw this, okay, there's wage increase coming, there's a bonus structure, and then we hear, well, in fact, the bonuses might be much trickier to qualify for than originally reported, and in fact, some stores are going to be closing.
Yeah, it was sort of giving with one hand and taking away with another. So Walmart announced that they're going to raise the minimum wage at their stores from $10, actually 9 to 10. It's kind of funny. Even there, it gets a little confusing. But so you start off at $9 an hour, and after training, you're at 10. Well, they're saying, well, now it's going to be 11. So immediately, everyone's going to be getting about a 10% pay raise if you make the minimum wage. And then also, there's this bonus pool, as you referred to, which is up to $1,000. But in order to reach that $1,000, you have to work there 20 years. And actually, they point out that there's something like 60,000 workers who have worked at Walmart and would qualify for this for 20 years, because Walmart is the largest private employer in the country with over 1 million workers in the U.S. So they announced that, and they also, you know, to their credit, announced better paternal leave policies and an adoption credit, some help with that assistance for families who need to adopt. So those are all great policies that they announced, and they credited that to tax reform, you know, the big savings that they're going to get when the corporate rate drops this year from 35% to 21%. But at the same time, they also said, oh, by the way, we're also closing 63 Sam Club stores, which is going to result in thousands of job losses. So it's sort of a confusing day, and, you know, people sort of picked and choose about which ones they sort of paid attention to.
Right, right. And it was interesting to see the filter through which different people were interpreting different stories and taking on different pieces of this story. So what is kind of the next beat or the next shoe to drop here as we're following this story along?
It'll be interesting to see how long it stays at $11 an hour. I mean, they credited the tax reform for sort of pushing this through. But, you know, last year before tax reform, Target, one of its main competitors, raised its minimum wage to $11 an hour. So they were sort of matching that. And then Target also said by 2020, they're going to hopefully get to $15 an hour. So, you know, Walmart will probably need to match that because they're competing for the same sort of workforce in that area. And as everyone knows, you know, the economy is improving. Unemployment, you know, sits in the fours. You know, retail especially is sort of clamoring for workers. So, you know, they probably need to raise wages anyhow. That has absolutely nothing to do with tax reform. This makes it a little bit easier for them. But, you know, Walmart is under a lot of pressure. All of retail is under a lot of pressure from Amazon. And the Sam's Club stores are under pressure because of Costco, their main competitor in that space, which has just done a lot better than the Sam's Club stores. So Walmart is still a behemoth, but it's under attack, and it's sort of worried about how it's going to proceed.
And given the Sam's Club, Costco, contentious competitor relationship there, does in your mind, is this pointing towards, or maybe you saw evidence in reporting this story, is there evidence of some bigger move coming from Walmart that will perhaps shift into a different space or somehow look for competitive advantage over other, you know, shopping club kind of places?
Yeah, no, you know, everyone's been sort of anticipating that Walmart needs to make some big moves, and that a lot of that attention has been focused actually in the online space where they're trying to catch up with Amazon. But and also in their warehouse space with competing against Costco, there's not much they can do in terms of innovation and sort of figuring that or acquiring. I don't think anyone expects them to acquire Costco.
But, you know, it is notable that they're closing stores and sort of giving up some of the fight in that space. But, you know, their biggest worry, and all of retail's biggest worry, is really Amazon, you know. Right. That's what scares everyone, and Walmart especially.
Right, right. And do we have a sense of what we're looking at in terms of numbers of the job loss after these 63 Sam's Club stores will be closed?
They didn't put out a number. Some analysts put in the 3,000 to 5,000 number range. But Walmart also pointed out that they'd be offering these associates jobs elsewhere, either at other Sam's Clubs in the areas or Walmarts. So, you know, we'll have to wait to see exactly how many people will lose their jobs. Although already some of these stores have closed. Apparently some workers got to work on Thursday and the doors were locked. And that was their first notice that, you know, they no longer have a job.
Wow, nothing like a surprise day off. Look at that. My goodness. Right. Well, okay. Well, we will continue to turn to you for the latest on this. And what things should we be looking for as this story continues to unfold? Is this, it seems like there's a lot of wait and see here.
Yeah, I think there is a lot of wait and see. And it's interesting, the tax reform sort of thrown this new wrinkle into it, where a lot of analysts expected that Walmart had to raise wages anyhow.
Yeah.
Now they're crediting tax reform. Now, does this tax reform, those savings there, give them enough ammunition to go after and fight Amazon better? We'll have to wait and see on that one.
Yeah, a lot of wait and see right now, especially in that retail space. Thank you so much, Todd Frankel, reporter at Washington Post, for being with us today.
Definitely. Thank you.
All right. We're going to take a little break, back in just a bit, and we're going to be talking about a trend in Chicago of hospitals giving housing options to homeless patients. Back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. There, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. You know, regular contributor of this show, Alexia Elahalde Ruiz, always does such a great job of finding really interesting, unusual stories. Sometimes things that fly under our radar in this time of tons of news stories flying at us. And this story that she recently created is no different. She wrote about the trend of Chicago hospitals giving permanent housing to homeless patients. Really, really interesting idea. Alexia, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, so talk us through this story. This is a really interesting one. It seems like such an unprecedented move. It also seems like a wonderfully obvious move to help people with health outcomes, but one you just don't hear about. We're often so tied by regulation and other things in the healthcare industry.
Yeah, so a handful of hospitals in the area, it's still kind of a fledgling effort, are starting to invest in housing for chronically homeless patients. The thinking being that these are people they see regularly in their emergency rooms, either because they're really sick, because living under, you know, a freeway is a sure way to exacerbate health problems, or because they're really cold or scared in the streets and in a hospital ER is a warmer, safer place to be. That's very expensive, as we all know, if we've ever gotten a bill from the ER. And so the hospitals are saying, well, wouldn't it save us money if we actually just invest in permanent supportive housing for some of these patients? So University of Illinois Hospital kind of launched a pilot program a couple of years ago with 26 participants, and they poured $250,000 in it. And after showing some success, they announced this week that they were going to extend the program to another 25 participants and put another $250,000 in it. And a few other hospitals in the area are doing similar pilots or have their, you know, programs of their own.
And how is this being funded? Is this from donors? Is this grants? Is this from the hospital themselves?
So the hospital, I can tell you about University of Illinois in particular. So they are spending $1,000 per month per patient going towards supportive housing. That's coming from the hospital itself. In the case of Swedish Covenant, for example, they have put in $75,000 to support, I believe it's 10 patients for a year. That's coming from their charitable arm of the hospital. So a lot of these hospitals have foundations, so they're tapping into that money to fund the program. The money for the rent itself for the housing units are coming from federal housing and urban development grants. So basically, these hospitals are working with providers, with supportive housing providers that have these HUD grants. And basically, the hospital's role is to recruit the patients and pay for the supportive services to have them living in these places.
Well, it's a very interesting program, and it's heartened to see it, taking on a little more and growing a bit. What does it look like the savings are coming out to be per patient as we're looking at, $1,000 per person to cover some housing expenses and services, versus chronic, health issues that land people in an ER?
So U of I found, just from its first pilot cohort, that they were seeing healthcare costs per patient reduce an average of just under $1,000. I think it was a month. Now I'm not remembering exactly, but it was $5,800 or something before the program, and after the program, it was, let's say, $2,700. Now that, so they're saying, like, it's not like this program themselves is making that much of a difference in their costs. But these are people who wouldn't just go to U of I. They also would go to Stroger and to the trauma, to the emergency room at Sinai or whatever. They go to a lot of different hospitals. And so by them being in housing doesn't just help U of I, it helps all these other hospitals as well. And then so what they're saying, though, is that if all the hospitals in the area were to participate and, say, house like 10 people, provide, help invest in housing for 10 people, that would have savings just system-wide. If these people were not frequenting the emergency rooms, not only would it just, save on those costs, but it would improve their health so that they would just have fewer health problems. That's good for money reasons, but also, the hospital was sure to emphasize that the primary motivation was not cost savings. It was access and equity, health equity, and just getting these people the care that they require.
Right. And it's so, it's tempting to start this conversation about money because it seems like that is always the bottom line in healthcare. So it's another really surprising layer of this that's so heartwarming to see this being about human beings and health and things like that. How many, so if we had all hospitals participating at 10, that still seems like a pretty small dent in the overall homeless population of Chicago. Is there a long-term strategy to be, to widen this even bigger to try to accommodate more people?
The city has not in my story, but the city has recently started kind of a fund to get, I think it's private donations and other systems like corrections and healthcare systems to put money towards housing for homeless people. So I think that the idea is that all the institutions and all the systems that are paying a lot of money because of the fallout of homelessness, so that's not just healthcare, that's things like corrections and other supportive services like that, they all have a stake in housing people because it just reduces their usage of those other services down the line. So I know the city has something going on. I'm less familiar with the details of it. But as far as how the hospital systems work, I think that they're just chipping away at trying to get all the major hospital systems at the table so that they can make this kind of a system-wide thing. And they've done it. Other cities have done it. Portland is one that has a model for this as well. So it's not the first time that it's been done, period, but it's kind of a newer thing in the Chicago area.
That was my very next question. If other cities have done this, what has Portland learned from this?
What a great question. If only I had researched with more. I don't know. I do know that it was successful enough that they have continued the program, mm-hmm. and that Chicago points to Portland as an example of where it's been working.
Yeah. Well, it seems like there's a lot of things that Portland has piloted that we have learned from. So it seems like a very innovative vibe there in Portland. And so what, the real question here is, are we seeing, I have to assume that we are seeing improved health outcomes as people have stable housing, as, just basic needs are being met.
Yeah, the hospitals are saying that they're seeing people use their they're going to the ER less, partly because they don't need to go to get off the street, and also because their health conditions are improving. I spoke with one woman in particular who is a part of University of Illinois Hospital's pilot program, and she said, she has a lot of health problems. She has, she's bipolar, she has asthma, she has liver issues, she has heart issues, all this stuff. And she says she has never felt better than since she's been in housed. She still had to go to the hospital a couple times because of her serious health problems, but she doesn't go nearly as frequently as she has had to before. And she has all these doctor's appointments now for preventive care, which she didn't obviously have before. And so she's, you know, her challenge is kind of keeping up with this schedule of, you know, all these doctors who she needs to see and medication she's taking.
Right, right. Which is, you know, preventative. Anytime we can get anything, you know, taken care of sooner rather than later, that's always, almost always going to be a more favorable outcome. So what is the kind of the next steps we're looking at as we're continuing to pilot this and hospitals are trying to get all the hospitals represented at the table?
I mean, I think that's what it is. It's just, you know, Presence Health, for example, is launching their pilot sometime this year. Rush, you know, is starting theirs this year. So I think it's just a question. The next step is just for more hospitals to get on board and to have these programs and also to keep track of it. One thing that's very challenging is to know how many homeless people are out there, who is homeless, and where, how many and where the housing units are. So another big chunk part of this is kind of keeping inventory of the people and of the housing so that the matches can be best made, because some people require more support than others. So in addition to just getting everyone on board and thinking that this is a good idea, it's a question of doing it effectively so that the people who participate in the program actually succeed, because some people do have a harder time living on their own and thrive better in other situations.
Sure, sure. And is there any backlash to this? I mean, it really seems like a no-brainer. It really seems like the best move involved for health outcomes, for the human being part of it, for the financial part of it. It seems like there wouldn't be backlash, but I know there always is. So who is the opposition here? Who's pushing back against this program?
I haven't encountered anyone who's pushing back on it. That doesn't say that there's not people out there who say that this shouldn't be the case. But it's hard to imagine. Like, what do you want them to do? Like, I think that most people agree that homelessness is bad, right? And that you don't want people out there suffering on the streets. And I think that once people realize that it costs less to house them than to just let them be on the streets, then that, I think, is something that everybody can get behind. Because usually opposition to this stuff is around cost and, you know, how much is this costing me as a taxpayer or whatever. But this is federal housing money that exists. This is coming from hospital coffers. You know, they're deciding that it is in their interest to do it. So I can't imagine that anybody would be angered by, you know, housing people who can't house themselves. I mean, these aren't people who are, you know, these are people who really are, who need help, right? Yeah. This is where society's safety net really kicks in, as far as like, this is who, you know, who needs kind of the social support services that are out there, because without it, it's not a choice. You know, this is not something that people just think it's like super funsies to live on their own. The people, I mean, and there are people obviously who might prefer to be out there, and that's okay. But for the people who would prefer to be and would do better housed, I think everyone can agree that it would be nice to make that an option for them.
Truly. Yeah. Is there a particular coalition that is formed around this? Something, is there, you know, a nonprofit or an organization where people could maybe visit a website to learn more about it?
So the Center for Housing and Health, which is a subsidiary of the AIDS Foundation, is working with a lot of these hospitals to get these programs in place. They're coordinating, you know, getting the housing units and finding where there's housing available, et cetera. I haven't seen that there's a whole bunch of information, you know, in a centralized place. Mm-hmm. There is like an alliance that is, like, I can't remember the alliance is called, but there is a local alliance that's been formed to address the issue. The leader of that is a guy named Stephen Brown, who is at University of Illinois Hospital. He heads up the preventive medicine department there. So he's kind of the leader on it. So if people want to get involved, I mean, I would reach out to U of I and get connected with Stephen Brown, or connect to the Center of Housing and Health and to learn more about it. But yeah, it's not like there's some great website where you can learn more, unfortunately.
Right. Well, that's often the case, though. Sometimes some of the best efforts are done so informally and grow into things later. Well, thank you so much for this discussion. This is a really interesting project happening right here in Chicago. Alexia Elizalde Ruiz, workplace reporter at Chicago Tribune. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
All right, we're going to take a little break. Plenty more to talk about when we get back here on the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. 720 WGN. It's Amy Guth wrapping things up here on the Wind Trust Business Lunch. We're playing that song, and by we, I mean esteemed producer Griffin Filipich, who always plays all those good songs you hear. We're playing that Bob Marley song because there's a really interesting piece in the New York Times right now. It's the headline on it, buying a piece of Bob Marley's song catalog and his enduring legacy. It seems like, on the outset, a piece about Bob Marley and his musical career and legacy, but really, this piece is more about, it's more of a look about the current state of the music industry and what streaming has done. It's a really, really interesting piece. Again, that's at newyorktimes.com. I recommend you check it out. But it's really all about the value of owning a catalog of music. I think that's something we talk about a lot when we lose an artist. We see who owns that, especially when it becomes contentious or controversial, like someone won't budge.
The Beatles is the greatest ongoing saga.
Absolutely. That's such a big one.
Well, I was interested in this Bob Marley one. It sold for something like $50 million.
Right.
Which I don't even know what to make of that number. It actually struck me initially as low, but I don't know the business at all. At first I was like, could it be more? And the Beatles one is hard to track down exactly what the worth is because now ownership is in a couple different places. Sony owns a lot of it, but Paul McCartney got back some undisclosed share in a settlement with them. And that, of course, was after all the Michael Jackson stuff happened. He bought the rights to the Beatles songs in the 80s for something like $50
million.
That's also
right.
Back then, $50 million.
And I feel like that was another pretty high-profile one.
Oh, gosh.
They hated each other. Oh, my God.
Paul McCartney hated him after that.
Huge war between those.
It looks like now the Beatles are around something like $2 billion total.
Right.
But it's kind of hard to tell.
Right.
Anyway, sorry.
I do predict that in the year-ish ahead, I think we're going to see some major reformation in this space of streaming. I think more artists are like, I got, 100,000 plays on my song on Spotify, but that got me $40. Like, that's gotten nowhere. So, and coupled with the legacy of buying these, big catalogs of huge iconic star brands, I think it'll be really interesting.
Yeah, and we can move on, but that story is interesting because the company that bought the music, they're really interested in like taking these old songs and pushing them into new spaces.
Right.
And that's how they get a lot of artists on board to sell them their rights. And,
right. Remember that song that hasn't been on in 30 years? Let's play that again and put it in an ad and make it an earworm. Yeah.
Anyway.
It is really interesting. I'll tweet this story out a little bit later in the day if you follow me on Twitter. Really interesting stuff. That does it for us, though. We are out of time here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. It is time to welcome our good friend Scott Catoon into the house. What you got going on the show, Startup Showcase today?
We have a big get today. We've got a head of startups from Google here. So he's going to be my guest host.
I've heard of it.
Yeah, it's this little search engine company.
It's a thing.
It's a little thing. No, he's going to come here and we're going to talk a little bit about Google Cloud, which is going against Amazon AWS. And then we've got another cool get today, a youngster, a 14-year-old who had an invention and won an award on Jimmy Fallon's show. He's here in studio as well. So we're going to...
What's his invention?
Well, you have to listen to get the invention, but I'll tell you that if you're a pet owner, this is money.
Okay.
So if you're a dog owner like I am and your dog makes a terrible mess everywhere, this is going to be so money. And then also, we're supposed to have a call in another company you can invest in live that's running campaign on Republic, but she's in a snowstorm. So we don't want to contribute to any dangerous driving. So if she can't make it, she won't be here. But, we've got Google, so we're good.
So there you go. We'll have a great show.
Thank you very much.